This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley in Washington. American theater has long been a place to have tough conversations. But as the world has changed, theater has too. Where interracial relationships and drug use were once too taboo to talk about on TV, shows like Rent filled a gap in that conversation. And it seems like nowadays the hot-button topic on stage is mental health. Shows like Next to Normal and Dear Evan Hansen are incredibly popular both with longtime theater fans and newcomers. But the issue of how best to portray those tormented minds has been with us since the days of Shakespeare. Just ahead, we'll talk about what theater can teach us about mental health, what it's doing right, and where, if we're not careful, it could go wrong.
Support for NPR and the following message come from U.S. Army Medicine, one of the nation's innovative medical institutions that puts healthcare professionals at the forefront of medicine. U.S. Army Medicine is an elite team pioneering new medical discoveries to make a difference in the lives of Americans. Army Medicine is your chance to push medicine further. Learn more at goarmy.com/amed.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
From New York, Joe Iconis and Joe Trace. They join us from NPR New York. They're the creative team behind Be More Chill. It opens off-Broadway next week. So I guess congratulations are in order first, Joe and Joe.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's start with, actually, let's hear a little bit from the musical itself. Be More Chill addresses anxiety and a sort of crippling adolescent self-consciousness, and it uses a sci-fi lens. The main character gets this implant that lets him be more chill. And so this is the song Voices in My Head, and there's obviously the literal meaning of that and the figurative one as well.
Voices in my head, so many voices in my head, and they can yell at her like hell, but I know I'll be fine. Still have voices in my head, and there are voices in my head, of the voices in my head, the loudest one is mine.
So this is a serious topic. That's an upbeat, kind of cheerful song, right? How do you sort of balance the seriousness of the issue with having to create entertainment?
I think that Be More Chill takes place and it takes place in a world that feels like it sits just beside our actual world that we live in 2018. And so it's, you know, all the issues and things that people deal with today are there in the show. It's just a little bit heightened, right? And so the idea is to sort of talk about these issues and, you know, talk about anxiety and depression and all of that stuff, but in a way that doesn't make it feel like an issue. You know, it's sort of like the characters are going through all of this, the things that many people go through in real life, and the sort of nonchalance with how that's treated is intentional. You know, we didn't want to write a show that felt like an issue show. We sort of wanted to mirror actual life, which is like people, you know, who are suffering with the things that we've been talking about. They have to deal with it, you know, and sort of the where our show gets to, you know, Voices in My Head is the final song. It's sort of where we end up. The understanding that everyone has, you know, voices in their head. Everyone is dealing with this stuff, and it's just the trick is figuring out how to navigate it all. You know?
So we got this comment from Hammerman, who wrote on our website, the1a.org, quote, mental illness is almost a prerequisite for actors. They're pretending to be multiple other people and really have to believe it themselves. I'm not sure that qualifies as a mental illness, but how do you deal with actors themselves asking them to portray mental illness?
As I said, the characters in the show are written, you know, pretty realistically, and so I don't think I don't think there's anyone in our show, at least, who was sort of challenged by the kind of mental illness that we're depicting in
what
the show.
What do you mean by that? Like, what portrayal of mental illness would be challenging? Are you talking about like a Sweeney Todd, someone who is violent?
Maybe. No, I don't. You know, I don't know. Perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, Be More Chill is based in a book by an author named Ned Vizzini, who struggled with clinical and suicidal depression.
And took his own life.
And he didn't. He wrote Be More Chill. Actually, he was 23 years old when he wrote it. And, you know, he was going through depression and wrote this book that dealt with what he was feeling through the lens of the sci-fi metaphor. So, you know, the main character, Jeremy, takes a pill that has a supercomputer in it, and the computer implants in his brain. It tells him what to do. It tells him what to say. You know, it is supposed to be this coping mechanism to thrive and survive. You know, and yet through the course of the show and the book, you start to see that maybe trusting this external voice that's telling you that you're not okay the way you are, that you're broken, that there's something wrong with you, is actually a harmful and dangerous thing. So, you know, it's this metaphor that lets us talk about how people really deal with those things in real life, you know, through a way that, you know, can, you know, expand to connect to any voices that you might be feeling, you know, whether that's, you know, peer pressure or the media or, you know, as Ned experienced, you know, clinical depression or anxiety. So, you know, it becomes a way to speak about these things, you know, through a metaphorical lens that lets you approach it with a lightness and a deftness that wouldn't necessarily be the case if we were tackling it from a more direct, head-on, metaphorless telling the story.
Which I guess what you're saying is that it's more sustainable that way. Let's play a clip, a bit of the song called Michael in the Bathroom. It is a quite visceral depiction of a panic attack. Here's a clip from the original cast recording. Michael here is played by George Salazar.
Is there a sadder sight than Michael in the bathroom at a party? This is a heinous night. I wish I stayed at home in bed watching cable porn, or wish I off myself instead. Wish I was never born. Ah, 'cause Michael, who's a loner, so he must be a stoner, rides a PT Cruiser. God, he's such a loser. Michael flying solo. Who you think that you know? Michael in the bathroom by himself. All by himself.
I mean, this is a performer who, in order to be authentic and give the best performance, needs to get as close to that authentic experience as possible. And so every night, sometimes twice a day, this actor is portraying a panic attack. And what you're saying is that sort of the lightness of the script, you try to put lightness in that to make that possible for the actor. Am I hearing that correct?
I mean, I think in the case of Michael in the Bathroom, that's probably as sort of visceral and extreme as we get in the show. And certainly that song is different from a lot of the other moments in the show. And I think the way that entire character is constructed is that he sort of fulfills the role of like the, you know, the best friend, right? The guy who seems to have everything together, the sort of goofy kid. And then, you know, when that song occurs in the second act, we're sort of seeing the cover kind of ripped off that, and we see how much is actually going on with him, and how much he's dealing with. And so in that case, the whole idea of the thing is to take a character in a situation, and you know, the literal situation is this kid who's at a Halloween party, this huge Halloween party, and he's hiding in the bathroom because he doesn't want to go out and deal with everybody. Take that situation, which feels sort of relatable and sort of like not an extraordinary thing, and turn it into something that feels huge. And so, the George Salazar performance, and George is doing the role in New York now too. It feels very, you know, much like an open wound, and it's definitely, you know, pushing him to be in a super vulnerable place. And and I think that's sort of the point of the whole thing, to temper the lightness with a moment that feels scary and extreme and feels, you know, connected to what an actual panic attack might feel like.
Do you think it's fair to say that your show, Be More Chill, is about mental illness?
I wouldn't. I don't think it's about mental illness, but I think that it's a story that contains mental illness. I don't know. What do you think, Chase?
Yeah, you know, I'd say that, you know, because we're using metaphor, it's able to stand in for, you know, multiple things. And, you know, obviously the, you know, the history of the material itself, you know, began with Ned saying, well, you know, you take a pill to deal with, you know, mental illness. They, you know, they prescribe you something that's supposed to fix your life, you know, and is that really a solution? What is that actually, you know, what does it mean to rely on a pill to deal with what's going on inside your head? You know, was the question that provided the crux of the story. So, you know, I think that's something that's, you know, it's a current that runs through it. You know, it's not the sole focus of the show, but it's one of the lenses you can put on it.
Almost 44 million adults in the U.S. suffer from mental illness. That's about 1 in 5, I think. Are you speaking to them? Who is your audience?
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, I think our audience is certainly people who struggle with mental illness. And, you know, from the reactions that we've gotten and the people we've met, so many people who struggle with mental illness identify with the show and with the characters in the show. And something that people really respond to is how the show doesn't make them feel different. It feels like, oh, this is the world that we live in, you know?
Without exploiting, obviously, mm-hmm. the suffering of another person.
For sure, yeah.
We've been speaking with Joe Iconis and Joe Trace, the creative team behind Be More Chill. It opens off-Broadway next week. Joe and Joe, thank you both so much for joining us, and good luck.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
I miss the mountains. I miss the highs and lows.
We're talking about mental health in the theater community, and we have a whole panel of professionals to help us navigate this. Kate Schindel is the president of Actors Equity. Kate, it's really great to have you back on 1A.
Hey, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Also in New York is Nisa Shashnani, director of the Drama Therapy Program at NYU. And here with me in the studio is Derek Goldman, professor and director of the Lab for Global Performance and Politics at Georgetown. Hi, Nisa and Derek.
Hi, thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
So we asked listeners actually to call in with stories about being in the theater community and around mental illness, and we have gotten an amazing response so far. Let's take a listen to two of the people who've called in.
Hi there. My name is Holly, and I am a stage actor in Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, my name is Joseph. I'm in Chicago, Illinois. I'm an actor and a person who struggles with mental illness, particularly depression.
I have generalized anxiety disorder, and a lot of the exercises in being present, in being relaxed and aware, in finding focus and empathy apply directly to stage acting work.
Men are taught not to talk to each other or other people about their feelings. And I was taught that way. And as an actor, I've been taught to be more sensitive and be more attuned to those feelings.
So, Kate, are there standards for the way these things are handled for performers? I remember doing Men of La Mancha, and there is a simulated rape scene in that show, and we had to bring in a counselor. The director brought in a counselor to help everyone through that. But that was the director's choice. Are there standards about this?
Well, as a union, we don't necessarily set the standards for the entire industry. There are some things that we can't control. And I just want to say that as a sort of preamble slash disclaimer. At the same time, over the last couple years, the issue of harassment and bullying in the theater has become very much front and center on our radar. And so we've taken a lot of steps to remind our bargaining partners and employers that it's their job to provide a safe and healthy workplace. I'm an actor as well. And so, you know, I understand where the previous comment was coming from in terms of actors having to pretend to be all kinds of different people. But I would respectfully disagree that all actors suffer from mental illness or deal with mental illness in their personal lives. The thing that I think gets difficult to navigate sometimes is that, look, happy, healthy, well-balanced people don't make the most interesting protagonists in a musical or play. So even though those of us who perform in those roles have all kinds of technique and and are able to learn as we grow how to leave things on stage after the play is over, we definitely do have to go to some dark places. And so I think that that is why, that's why historically you see that actors are tend to be a bit more open to sort of the injustices and pains of the world and of everyday life. And so I do think that it requires a special kind of oversight or at least attention to the fact that we're getting in there and going to those dark places over and over again.
So, Derek, Jennifer wrote this to us on Twitter, quote, "Mental illness is not merely metaphorical. To claim that we all struggle with voices in our head may seek to make mental illness less exceptional, but fails to recognize the depth of suffering those who truly hear voices deal with every day. Attitude seems flippant," end quote. And at the end, we're still talking about commercial profit-generating enterprises. How does that complicate the whole issue of dealing with mental illness in a responsible way?
Mm. Yeah, I was really struck by the use of the word empathy from the caller and thinking about that in some core way, what we do in the theater hasn't actually changed that much for 2,500 years since the Greeks, where someone is enacting or telling a story and someone else is in the audience is tasked with empathizing and being and connecting to that. And you know, there's a beautiful study that University College of London did that I think a lot of theater people have claimed, you know, sort of in a I knew that already way, but about how the heartbeats and pulses of an audience member and a performer actually move, are in sync with each other during a performance. And I feel like that's a really powerful not to be simplified or romanticized, like a really powerful image of the promise of the what can happen in the performer-audience relationship, that kind of connection. But I think ultimately, you know, a performer is up there in our world, often is up there in the dark, alone, as you were saying, repeating that work over and over again. And you know, what I think is happening in the industry that's really reassuring and long overdue is the awareness of the importance and complexity of support systems and power structures that a performer may be standing up there alone, but anyone who's in the performance world knows that they're actually never alone. There's a whole apparatus of, you know, of stage management and a production ethos and all of that that go into the kind of caretaking that happens in that world. So I do think empathy, you know, it's just been at the heart of everything we do in the theater since since Aeschylus, is kind of at the center of this.
Hanorama asks on the website, if there's a character that struggles with mental illness, must the production recruit actors with mental illness to portray such a character? We'll get into that and many more issues. We are talking to Kate Schindel, president of Actors Equity, Nisa Shashnani, director of the Drama Therapy Program at NYU, and Derek Goldman, professor and director of the Lab for Global Performance and Politics at Georgetown. More soon, so stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from ACT, a flexible CRM trusted by millions worldwide. Manage customer contacts, track sales opportunities, and create professional marketing campaigns, all from your laptop or mobile device. Call 888-643-6400. Mention promo code NPR for a free Amazon Dot with your purchase of ACT. Or visit act.com/NPR to sign up for a free 14-day trial. ACT. Growth made easy.
I'm Ann Powers from NPR Music. Last summer, we launched Turning the Tables, a project that radically changed how we talk about the history of popular music, with a list of the 150 greatest albums by women. This week, we're launching Season 2, looking at the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women. Check out who made the list and who didn't at n.pr/turningthetables.
Nisha, I wanted to get back to the show Evan Hansen, which has been incredibly successful. But for those who are not familiar with this particular show, it is physically quite exhausting as well. Lots of actors have acquired hunchbacks and nervous tics in order to play this role. I want to play a little bit of one of the final songs in the show. The character melts down on stage. And here is that moment performed by the original Evan, Ben Platt.
No, I'd rather pretend I'm something better than these broken parts. Pretend I'm something other than this mess that I am. Cause then I don't have to look at it. And no one gets to look at it. No, no one can really see. Turn the key before I make the mistake. Before I lead with the worst of me, I never let them see the worst of me.
Nisha, you deal with drama therapy. Is what we just heard some form of therapy for a performer, or is it simply exhausting?
I deal with therapists, people in training who want to become therapists, to work with actors and actors of everyday life, because we're all actors, to be able to use the tools and techniques of theater, storytelling, role play, improvisation, and performance to bring their stories, the voices in their head, to the stage, whether it's the stage in a group room or whether it's in front of a chosen audience. And participating in the theater professionally can certainly be an outlet to be able to explore some of the struggles, challenges, and interests that a person has. Of course, with that, as our previous guests have spoken about, as Kate spoke about, there's technique, there is practice with being able to sustain the craft. And so without those practices, without those sustainable practices, it's absolutely possible that one feels the distress that follows entering into substantial and demanding roles like Evan Hansen.
So we got a tweet from Tough Like a Girl who says one of the biggest obstacles to getting help for mental illness is the widely held stigma against people with mental health issues. When platforms like the media or Broadway present mental illness as a non-issue or otherwise normalize the things people go through, it's a win. But Kate Schindel, I wanted to play for you this comment from the conversation our producers had with Colton Ryan. He was the stand-in for Evan Hansen. And he says he worries about conversations in which they say theater is trying to drive change on its own.
Theater is reflective. It's often a little behind because it works in hindsight. That's when it works the greatest. And I worry that the theater sometimes is taking on these gigantic tentpole issues. And because of that, a lot of people view it as they go in the, and a lot of people see theater in a different way than, you know, theater artists do, like myself. A lot of people go, I forget all the time that there's a lot of people who see one play a year and walk away and went, oh, that was really, that was a nice time. And I mean that in the best of ways, that they probably will think about it and move on. But there needs to be other critical factors in building a different culture. The arts is a part of that.
Kate, what do you make of that argument that theater reflects change instead of drives it?
I agree and I disagree. I mean, I think that theater does both. Good theater does both. And, you know, some shows look back, some shows look forward, some shows take a huge leap that the culture isn't ready for yet. And it takes all kinds. You know, I would also say, and I very rarely talk about my personal life in public, but I dated someone for many years who had pretty severe post-traumatic stress. And I've seen more panic attacks than I can count. I've seen fugue states. I've seen anxiety attacks that even the paramedics thought were a heart attack. And I've never seen anything on stage that completely reflects what it's like in real life. Because when an audience goes to a theater, they know that they're there to watch some people play pretend. And to the extent that your technique can insulate you from actually living that real experience, I think that's, it's an important point to make. You know, I believe that theater is trying to examine and be representational of those issues, but honestly, if you're an audience member sitting in a theater, you have a pretty good sense that the person on stage is actually safe and has constructed this. And oftentimes, ironically, the catharsis when you actually are allowed to cry is it feels better than all of the anxiety that you've had to build up to that moment in order to reach that. So, I mean, it's hard for people to, I suppose, separate what it's like to play a character like that from what it's like to actually live that life. But But I think that they are two distinct things, no matter how strongly the theater is trying to explore those issues.
And I want to clarify something. Earlier, we might have misspoken or misrepresented a tweet from actor Jordan Woods Robinson. To set the record straight, he now says, "The point in my original tweet was that the acting community at large is a group of people who are constantly making themselves emotionally vulnerable and oftentimes being rejected even on a path to success. It takes a toll on all." And Derek, this brings me back to this idea about what is different now about the shows that we're seeing, because it's no surprise that theater takes on difficult issues. Cabaret was really about the Holocaust. Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote often about racism. So what has, if you buy the idea that these new shows, and we're talking about just Evan Hansen, but there's The Father, there's Spring Awakening, there's A Next to Normal that we've mentioned, all spotlight these characters who are suffering from mental illness, depression, dementia, anxiety. What do you think is different in what we're seeing, if there is something different?
Yeah, I mean, I think this may tie together a couple of the last threads of conversation, because I was thinking about how I think theater is also something we should not be cordoned off from the kinds of societal daily questions and topics and conversations and challenges that we're facing. And when theater is really working, we're fortunate at Georgetown with our Lab for Global Performance and Politics. It's very consciously using theater as a kind of catalyst for dialogue and for sort of change, to get into conversations with practitioners who are experts, whether it's from a policy standpoint, whether it's clinicians, whether it's migration and refugee experts. And I think there's a common misunderstanding that theater either is good or does good, you know, that there's a kind of that in certain kinds of spaces the quality can be up to a kind of huge artistic standard, and in other cases it's merely instrumental. It's merely theater for some social good. And what I am sort of feel privileged to witness is I think there's much more kind of flow across these different kinds of sectors and spaces where some of the most powerful work is happening, yes, at our beautiful leading theaters and opera houses, but also in homeless shelters, in refugee camps, in middle schools, in community settings, where plays are engaging dialogues and topics that are shifting the way the community thinks about issues like mental illness. Next to Normal, of course, gets performed on Broadway, but it continues to have a life in communities and in regions and on campuses where the work it's doing kind of goes on. And it's not just a product, it's a catalyst for a next set of conversations or even of new shows, of new material.
So Kate Schindel of Actors Equity, Josh and Ashley Harvey wrote on Facebook, quote, "The art may be part of connection to an issue or community, but it does not replace actual treatment and help by therapists, 12-step groups, doctors, and clinics." And I wonder how this conversation is going among the community in terms of better protecting performers. And it's not just Broadway either, right? Like I sing opera. Tosca has to throw herself off a building every night for however many nights as the opera goes. How is this conversation proceeding among the actors community?
Well, it's constant. And we represent not only actors, but also stage managers who often have to witness and deal with things in a somewhat different way, but can be put in a difficult position in trying to manage the workplace, which is actually the employer's responsibility. To me, I think that the top line issue is making sure that we have people who are going into workplaces. I mean, a lot of people don't think of the theater as a workplace, but we as a labor union do. And that the employer has the responsibility to make that a safe and healthy workplace. And to that end, we have we really have an eye on the fact that our members go into these workplaces and make themselves extremely vulnerable. And that can leave them open to a particular kind of treatment that is inappropriate in the workplace. And so we, over the last couple years, have asked every single one of our employers to send us their harassment policy, some of whom didn't even know that they needed to have a harassment policy, many of whom did and sent it along. We formed a president's committee to prevent harassment, which is not only sexual harassment, but also a hostile work environment. We have formed a partnership with the Actors Fund to support individuals who feel like they've been harassed or bullied in the workplace and need somebody to talk to, short of actually making a report to a business rep, which they are always also welcome to do. And we're really starting to dig in. I would say we've doubled down in the last year or two, even before the Weinstein revelations and all that followed, into the fact that people need to be able to feel like they're going to work and it's a safe place, especially since our lives and our jobs are so transient that it can leave the rest of our existence feeling more unstable than most people are used to. And after a while, that does take a toll.
And so, I want to be specific here, Kate, about exactly the kind of thing you're talking about, because we're talking about people who, over the course of their job, have to get dressed and undressed in front of large groups of people. Sometimes if the costume changes fast, they're not even undressing themselves. Or over the course of the performance, they may have to be naked or vulnerable in other ways, it put into situations, not just the rape scene that I was talking about, but put into situations that make them very vulnerable. I assume that's what you're referring to when you're talking about trying to make a potentially unsafe workplace safe.
Yeah, it's the physical vulnerability, but also the emotional vulnerability. And, you know, there are situations. There was a big situation in Chicago a couple years ago where it seemed as if a predatory individual used his position of power to manipulate and exploit the young women that worked with him. And that was quite an uproar, as it should have been, and the theater shut down. But there's a real spectrum of how that stuff can go down.
Part of what we're talking about, Nisha, here is sort of the emotional effects of handling quite openly serious mental illness. And I wonder what the responsibility is for a theater to inform audience members before they show up to the show. Does the theater have any responsibility to warn people before they come to Dear Evan Hansen that this is not Mary Poppins?
I think that's an interesting question. I mean, theaters will typically warn you if there are going to be very loud noises or very, very bright lights. Typically, a summary that's offered, the publicity that's offered around any particular play will offer some indication as to what the play is about. And I think in some of the musicals that you've mentioned that some of these issues are already directly referenced. I'm a little on the fence on that. I think that to some degree we can invite an audience to anticipate what's about to follow. Audiences are smart. They will do some of their own research around a show that they are purchasing a ticket to go see. And that, you know, creates a kind of contract. It doesn't mean that they may not be thrown off. I think that from, you know, if I think from a drama therapist point of view, I might think that there is reason to create post-performance experiences for audiences who would like to participate in some kind of dialogue or hear others be in dialogue. That might be a way of responsibly creating a space for some of the after effects. I've also seen productions where there have been inserts placed in the program around resources in the community that audiences might make use of if they would like to follow up on some of the concerns and issues raised in a performance. That's one direction a theater can take, and certainly with actors providing opportunity and practice with de-rolling and, you know, tightening the source of support that they get from being in the ensemble. Those are other sustainable practices that might be strengthened. So not totally directly answering your question. I think to some degree theaters can warn audiences, and sometimes that's just a spoiler alert.
I want to say thank you to all of our guests, Kate Schindel, president of Actors Equity, Nisha Shashnani, director of the drama therapy program at NYU. Derek Goldman is professor and director of the Lab for Global Performance and Politics at Georgetown. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Earlier this hour, we heard from Joe Trace and Joe Iconist, creators of Be More Chill. It opens off Broadway next week. Remember, there's much more to read about and explore online at the1a.org. That's where you can connect with us about upcoming episodes and debates. Just click Ask 1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headlee, sitting in for Joshua Johnson, who will be back tomorrow with the Friday News Roundup from the peerless, beautiful city of Detroit, Michigan. So thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.